What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Black Corporate Life Podcast, where we're breaking the silence and revealing the unwritten rules and hidden truths that govern corporate America. I'm your host, James Friesen. In this groundbreaking series, we're leaving no stone unturned. Join us as we champion authenticity and transparency and bring these topics front and center, one episode at a time. In today's episode, we'll discuss some of the things you need to know about networking and leveraging AI and job hunting. This is an episode you don't want to miss. Our guest today is David Edgerton Jr., who is the founder and managing principal of the DEJ Group, an executive search firm dedicated to connecting diverse talent with inclusive companies. David is the former adjunct faculty at the University of St. Thomas, Opus College of Business, and Bethel University. He also served as an entrepreneur in residence at the University of Minnesota. Early in his career, David worked in project management and information technology for Best Buy and Be The Match. He's also the former director of diversity, equity, and inclusion for Anderson Corporation. David holds an MBA from the University of Minnesota, Carlson School of Management, a Master of Arts from Concordia University, and a Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering from North Carolina A&T State University, Aggie Pride. Now, I've known David for over 30 years, going back to our days at A&T. He's my ice-cold line brother from the Spring 92 line of the Beta Epsilon chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. He's a husband, father, talented musician, and personal friend. David, welcome to the show, brother.
Thank you so much, my friend. It's good to see you. Good to be a part of what you're doing right here, man. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Oh, thank you for being here. Been excited, man. This is a long time coming, so I'm glad we had an opportunity to do this today. So, David, if you could start us off, tell us your career story. How did you get to where you are today?
Oh, wow. Career story. I'll make it quick as I possibly can. So once I left Aggieland, I started in engineering with my degree and worked for a couple of companies there, mostly in manufacturing. So I kind of went into manufacturing engineering and was working with equipment design, doing electrical systems for plants at the time, and worked for a company called Thompson Consumer Electronics in Pennsylvania and Indiana. So I spent about 5.5 years in Indiana. And one of the neat facts about my career, on 9/11, between the planes crashing, I got a call to join a company in Minnesota called Amation, which was a spinoff of 3M. It was their data storage division and a couple of other businesses that they put together as a package and spun it off of the company. And it became this company called Amation. So I stayed with them roughly 4 years. And then I worked on my MBA at the University of Minnesota. And after I got my MBA, decided to try to see what it was worth. So I started working for some different companies, did some more consulting, ended up at Best Buy, did some work for Best Buy in the Best Buy mobile unit when it was a joint venture with a company out of England called Carphone Warehouse. So if you remember, or anybody remembers that's listening, there used to be these Best Buy mobile stores for a while. Well, that whole project was something that I worked on, as well as the sale of iPhones in Best Buy, which was the first sale of iPhones outside of the exclusive agreement between Apple and AT&T, if y'all go back that far. We're talking iPhone 3, not iPhone 14, which is where we are today. So I did that, then eventually worked for Be The Match, which does bone marrow transplants, a nonprofit in the Twin Cities, and then eventually landed at Anderson Windows, which I was a project manager. Then I became a manufacturing IT technology leader, led all of the IT for manufacturing for the Renewal by Anderson business unit, which is the direct-to-consumer unit, and then became a director of diversity, equity, and inclusion, for which I left in 2019. And at the beginning of the pandemic, after I left, was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And then, of course, the DEJ Group came out of that time. And ever since then, I have been placing people in director, vice president, CEO roles for organizations, mostly nonprofit. But at the same time, we've done, I think now, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 22 of those. And most of the candidates we place in those six-figure roles and higher look like you and I, which is something I'm very proud to say. So that's what I've been doing. I continue to teach. I continue to speak. I continue to do all of those things in the entrepreneur space. I'm working with a cohort of entrepreneurs in Mobile, Alabama through the SBA to teach them a curriculum, which is what we call Street Smart MBA. And it's like a 6-month MBA program for founders. So I'm still teaching. I'm still doing entrepreneurship. I'm doing my own business. And I have 2 offices, one in Minnesota and one in outside of Washington, D.C., which is where I'm talking to you from now. And we're just continuing to grow and continue to learn and continue to help people. So that's how we got to where we are now.
Brother, you got a lot going on. You know, I think the term a lot of people use is like Swiss Army knife. Like you got a lot of different talents.
Appreciate that, man. Appreciate that.
So how did you transition? You transitioned from project management to information technology to diversity, equity, and inclusion. How were you able to make those transitions?
Oh, I'll tell you why. What happened was in around 2014, I was doing things like going to hackathons and I was going to different types of tech conferences. And I don't know what happened that year other than, you know, Microsoft, Google, and all the big companies started to open their books to show that even though, let's say 30% of the people that use the products they create look like us, only 1-2% of the people that look like us work for them. And I don't know why that bothered me. It just started to bother me. So what I ended up doing was I talked to HR and said, hey, let me go to some career events, some career fairs, job fairs, anything like that. One, so that there was representation, but two, to really just show that, you know, people that look like us are in technology, you know, and it wasn't a situation where they had to go hire an actor, for example, because they didn't have diversity in that space. So it started there with the recruiting piece. And then once I started doing that, the company took notice I was at and said, you know, why don't we have you be on our diversity council? So, okay. So I joined the diversity council. I want to join the diversity council. One of the first things they asked me was, you know, how can we increase diversity, you know, at our organization? I said, it's easy. I said, first of all, do you know what an HBCU is? And believe it or not, in 2017, 18, I had to explain that, right? So I said, I'll tell you what, if you've got some gender goals you would like to make or some ethnic goals, the way they defined it, right? I said, I can go to one place and get you all of that. And that's North Carolina A&T. So in 2000, I think it was 18, 19, somewhere in there, I took a couple of people to North Carolina A&T during the career fair. So we didn't go to homecoming. That would have been too much.
Overload.
That would have been too much, especially since the people I brought did not look like me and were of a different persuasion. You know, they were stuck with Bojangles as an example.
Wow.
We've never had chicken this good. Well, yeah. I mean, it's part of the environment. And then when we went to at the career fair, I think this was a great experience where, you know, Chancellor Martin was still there. I know he's retired now. One of my mentors when I was back in the program, and he walks up to me and said, hey man, I ain't seen you in so long. Where you been? Gave me a hug. It freaked these people out. He said, he knows the chancellor like that. It's like, oh yeah. I remember being in an event and I was struggling on an exam and he came over and wrote the equation on a piece of a napkin. He said, man, go study this right quick. Then go take that test again kind of thing. So I explained this as part of, you know, how we do things at an HBCU. And they were like, oh my God, we need to keep coming back. I was like, yeah, you do. So after that experience, it had such a positive impact. That's when they came to me like the following year. It's like, look, why don't you be our diversity, equity, inclusion manager or director at the time? And that was the first one. So that was 2019. So by 2019, went through that year. And then at the end of the year, what I found out later was that we were coming up a little short on profit and they did these layoffs and I was part of that layoff piece, right? I just started a job, you know, first one in, first one out kind of situation. So I spent 2020 once I left there trying to figure out, you know, kind of what to do. So that's how I made the transition. It came out of, I worked in technology. I didn't see people that looked like me in technology and wanted that to change. So I was the change I wanted to see.
Cool. So, man, that's very interesting. So then tell us, how did you make the transition from going from the corporate world to executive recruiting? Because you decided to start your own company.
Yeah. Let me tell you, for me, that was not something I had pretty much decided to do, but I knew I had to do it eventually. And I'm kind of glad it happened the way it did. So when I left Anderson, that was a situation where I was pretty much laid off with another few hundred people, I heard that day, right? So now I'm out, don't have a role. And it was all of a sudden. So I wasn't prepared to leave from a standpoint of what's the next thing. I wasn't prepared because I walked in on a Monday and it was like 4:30. You don't have a job anymore kind of thing. So it's like, oh man, now I'm just out there, right? So I took December and the next few months just to deal with, you know, the trauma of that, which we don't really talk about. So I'm glad we're having this type of conversation. You know, there's a trauma there that goes around, you know, you have a job and all of a sudden you don't have one. And it's like, you didn't see it coming. It was the, you know, come out of nowhere situation that's like, oh, now what do you do? So the first couple of quarters, man, I just dealt with, okay, I don't have a job. Do I go find another job? Because my situation was interesting because I had just gotten into diversity. I just gotten into HR, all of that. And when I left, I only had like a year of experience professionally doing it. So to go somewhere else and try to do it was difficult because they would look at your resume and say, oh, well, you only got a year. You don't have enough experience doing this. So then the other part of that, which I started to see was, okay, well, I can go back and do technology. Well, when I started looking at those roles, a similar thing started to happen. And I started to see the beginning of what we would call ageism. So the ageism topic is very, very prevalent at this point, because now I'm applying for not CIO roles, which I could do, not vice president, not director. I started applying for roles like project manager, you know, program manager, things like that at organizations. And it was just saying, hey, great resume, great experience. I mean, I had, 20 years. But, we don't think you're the right person for the job. And I kept getting that. What is a input to me starting my company and going into executive search, because you might ask me about that later, but this is a good time to kind of talk about it, is I was up for a director of IT job at the end of 2020. I went through 4 stages of interviews. And I remember getting to the last stage thinking, oh man, this might actually happen. So I might be a director of information technology for a multi-billion dollar foundation. So that was what the job was. And then I was the runner up. So there's the person in front of me that got the job. Now, am I upset, disappointed about the job? Well, you know, you think you're that close, you think you got it. Yeah, but here's what got me and really set me off to get out of corporate. When I asked for feedback to the hiring manager said, we don't know if you could have really done the job. Now, this is after first 2 sets of interviews with her and another person, a set of interviews with the team I would have run, a set of interviews with the peers to the director, you know, of all the different functions, an interview with the CEO, and a psychological assessment to, you know, we're at the end, right? And after that, they said, we still can't decide. So we need you to do a 30, 60, 90 plan. And we need you to come up with a strategy to help us take our IT to the next level over the next 5 years, which I did within a week kind of thing. And she said, we didn't know if you were technical. That day, I said, I am not going to ask anybody else for a job.
Wow.
That day, after I heard that. And a month later, I had the conversation with my oldest son, David Lee Edgerton III, who is finishing his 2nd year of law school, will be an attorney next year. So we go out to get some chicken. And the first thing he does is, he almost treated me like a frat brother, which was kind of funny. He said, Dad, what are we doing? I was like, what do you mean, what are we doing? I said, man, this has just happened. I'm telling them what's going on, right? And then he checked me like a grown man. He said, Dad, wait a minute. You helped all these people, you know, start these businesses, make all this money. You got a person who listened to you who went from like 500,000 to 5 million just listening to you. And you can't solve this for yourself? What we doing? That's my oldest son, father of my grandson and granddaughter. Now, telling his dad, basically giving me what I gave him before he left to go to Howard University kind of stuff. So I said, we're going to start this gig. So I started my company. And when I started the company, I said, what I'm going to do is do executive search. And here's how I came to that. Two things. One, I believe I can communicate. I can talk to people. I meet no strangers. Two, I thought I could sell. I know I could sell. So those two things, I said, okay, that's a great foundation to start a new company. Then the next thing was I had just gone through an executive search with that job that I didn't get. So I turned around and took the whole process I had gone through and made it my initial executive search process. So I had a process, I had me, and I had a network, which we'll go probably maybe talk about later. And I just said, I'm doing this. And people were like, oh, you're doing this? Well, we need some help. We need some help. We need some help. Even though I had no experience, practical experience doing it, I got my first contract within the first 2 weeks of saying I was going to do it. Wow. I mean, that doesn't happen. But in my case, it did. So I did the first one in January of 2021, got that done by March, got another one right after that, because as soon as you do that one, marketer says, well, guess what I can do? I can tell somebody. So I told someone I did that one. They were like, oh, you did that one? Well, you think you can do this one? Yeah, I think I can do that. And my answer to every customer is, yes, we can do that. I said, yes, we can do that. And then you go figure it out. So I, in my first year in the business, I think I did 11 within that first year, which is crazy. But yeah, that's what we did. So that's how I was able to get out of corporate, man. I mean, it really got me to a point where I started to see what people really were doing as far as that goes. And I said, I have a better chance on my own working for myself than I do in any organization.
Well, now that is an incredible story, and it speaks to your character and courage, being able to go from adversity to triumph.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly what you did.
Oh, yeah, man. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And one of the things, the hidden jewels that's mentioned in there is networking. That you were able to leverage your network from your corporate experience to kick off your executive recruiting. So if you could just, you know, how would you define networking? And just kind of tell us how you're able to leverage that in your career, especially with starting your own business.
Absolutely. I would tell you that networking or having a network was probably the only reason I was able to have as much success as fast as I did. Because going into executive search as an industry, it is all about relationships. It's all about networking. It's all about who you know, right? So for me, I look at networking in a couple of ways. The first way I look at it is, in order to really do it, you shouldn't go into networking with the mindset of, this is what I'm trying to get from someone. What you should do is position yourself as the resource to the person you're trying to connect with and try to serve them. That is how I do networking. That's how some experts have started to kind of look at that and say, well, how do you get people to, you know, listen to you? How do you get people to give you some of their time? Well, you have to have some value that you've created that you're able to offer someone to even get their attention in this attention deficit time zone that we live in now. So you got to be able to walk up to someone and say, hey, you know, I noticed that you do these kinds of things. You're into these types of hobbies. You're into this type of business. Hey, I got something that might be able to help you be successful. So if you go into it with trying to help someone else be successful with whatever it is that you have to offer, that is a good first step.
I wrote a little ebook, and I want to make sure that I get this to you and your audience for free. There's nothing in it to make you buy anything or all that. But it's called the Connectors Formula. I came up with that term. And basically, it's a four-step process. And basically, that four-step process is seed your network, feed your network, weed your network before you need your network. Okay, so let me walk through those real fast. So to seed your network basically is what I just explained by being a resource. So you're planting seeds with the connections that you have that show that you're adding value to them, and you're watering those seeds so that value starts to grow and they're able to take advantage of it. So that's seeding your network. Feeding the network. Well, once you've planted the seeds, now you gotta, you know, feed it. In other words, you have to follow up. You have to connect with people. You have to make sure that whatever you've created for them from a value perspective is working for them. And if it's not, you should figure out how to serve them even more. So once you plant seeds, you must feed the seeds, right, in your network. Weed your network. That's a funny one, because what happens is over time, there are people that are in your life, in your network, around you that don't need to be there. They're either there for a season or a reason. Right? So if they're there for a season or a reason, you have to figure out what that is. And if it's not helping you get to where you ultimately want to go, then you have to respectfully decline, respectfully step away, respectfully take and harvest your energy, conserve your energy for the folks that are taking you in the direction you need to go. So that's weeding your network. You're getting all the stuff out of it that doesn't help it be healthy. And if you do those three things, then when you get ready to need your network, it will come back to you based on the fact that you planted seeds, you fed those seeds, and you took care of those seeds, and you weeded those seeds. Now, the harvest that comes back is opportunities. The other harvest that comes back is basically being able to connect with other people. So people see you adding value to them, then they will say, hey, maybe you can add value to this person. That's how that thing starts to grow. So that's just my little framework. I put it in a little guidebook. It's like a little 20-page guidebook. I'm going to make sure you have that for your audience. Just free charge, no problem. And it's just a little guide to help people that are nervous about doing it, you know, realize that it's really not that hard. Unless you're just scared of people and you're scared to communicate. If that's your issue, then we can talk about that too. But if you're, you know, like, yeah, I like people, I like this, but I just don't know what to do, that little guy will help you with that.
No, I appreciate that. That's dope. I've not heard it put in that perspective before. Yeah, so I appreciate you sharing that. Absolutely. So talking about executive recruiting, can you describe what is that process like, the process of executive recruiting? How does it work?
Yeah, I'll explain that, because some people confuse it with recruiting, executive search with recruiting, and it is totally different. First of all, there are two types of searches that go on. The first one is from the firm's perspective. So what we do is retained searches. Retained means that the client hires us to exclusively handle the search for a particular role. So all of the roles that I've done in maybe less than 25 in the last 3 years, all of them have been retained searches where I and my firm are the only ones handling it. Contingent searches are where firms will say, I'm going to sub this out to say 5 or 6 different firms, and the first one that brings a person gets paid. Now, the problem with that is, from a firm perspective, you do all the work, you do all the searching, you do all the sourcing, all the interviewing to bring somebody to a client. And if they don't hire them, you don't get paid at all, right? Well, that also works for retained, but the problem is you spend all this resources, all these resources and time to go after a person and you get nothing for it. So that's like an investment on you up front. Whereas retain search is a little bit different, and it definitely works for our model because we get paid as we go. So we get a third of a fee when we start a search. Once we sign a contract, we get a third. Then we get a third once we found people and we start interviewing people. Then we get the last third when they've hired somebody out of the pool that they've interviewed. And that third, those three thirds together represent, in the industry, 25 33% of the starting salary of the role. Okay. So me, as an entrepreneur being scrappy, I'm just charging 20% of the role. So if you think about, I just saw a request for a proposal today where they're going to pay a person, and I'll use the nice round number, $600,000 a year. Nice gig. Nice gig. And executive search firms, those are the ones they usually get. Gigs like that. I get some that are smaller than that because we're a smaller firm and we're doing nonprofit too. But the for-profit gigs, yeah, 600 grand, I've seen that one. So for 600 grand, for a retained search, the fee on that is 200,000. So you're going to pay somebody 200 to get you somebody for a 600 job. Now, I charge 20%. So for me, if I got that, that would be $120,000 versus 200,000. So one of my competitive advantages with that is to show that I can still deliver a high quality product in a good search process, in bringing good talent to the role, they get hired for a little bit less than the industry. So that's why I'm able to get a lot of gigs that I get for that. But yeah, that's how that works. There's contingency versus retained. And retained basically is the client pays as you go versus contingency, they pay once the person's hired, but you got to do all the work to bring them and they got to pick your person. So there's more risk on the table with the contingency piece.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's very insightful. So along those lines, mm-hmm. can you talk about what does an executive recruiter look for in a candidate?
Oh man, that's a great, great, great question.
Black Corporate Life is a leadership training and development company focused on empowering Black professionals to thrive in corporate America. We provide classes, coaching, and an online community of like-minded individuals to help Black men and women in corporate America reach their full potential. Join our online community at bclalliance.com.
Now, in a candidate, what an executive recruiter would do, and this is something I'm actually adding as an offering to my firm, is we are definitely looking for leaders who have different types of functional backgrounds, right? It depends. I've done HR roles, I've done finance roles, I've done development roles in nonprofit, I've done philanthropy roles and development roles are kind of the same, advancement roles, done all of those, right? So depending on the function, of course, if it's a finance person, you're looking for, you know, finance background, probably has done some accounting, probably has done some corporate finance, you know, general ledger, you know, all that kind of stuff. If you're looking for HR people, you're looking for people that are familiar with benefits, compensation, looking for, you know, they have to have some talent acquisition type of experience as well. Mostly people who have led teams and get the work done through the teams, right? For development and advancement, people who have raised funds through either, you know, individual gifts, through what we call institutional gifts, you know, foundations and different things like that. And people who have really got a sense of how to do true fundraising and donor advocacy and donor development. So things like that. At the end of the day, though, we offer assessments for a client to have the different candidates go through so that their personality assessment goes with the culture. So you're also looking for a match or a fit to the culture of the organization. And we use those really scientific assessments to at least get somewhat of a picture of what that looks like. So between that and their background, that's what we look for. We also have them do career assessments where they assess themselves. So we can kind of see, you know, how do they really describe their results and how they do things. And between all of that, we sit down usually with a search committee or a team and we go through profiles and profiles and profiles. And once we go through the profiles, I make a recommendation of, you know, who they should probably talk to based on what they told me. And then that's how they get into the evaluation process. So we have a 4-step process, something I'm actually thinking about trademarking myself because a lot of firms do that. And it's 4 S's. So we start with the strategy. We then do the sourcing. Then we do the selection, and then we do the support. So our firm provides after selection support or onboarding, once they've chosen the person to go into the role, and that could be anything from a class on fundraising, for example, if they're a new fundraiser or in that new role, or some things where we provide through our network resources and leadership development, any kind of coaching. I also do executive coaching. I have 4 clients in that space where we brought them from, you know, the roles they were in into executive director roles. I've got one who won Entrepreneur of the Year this past year that I've coached. So that executive coaching is part of that onboarding that we also provide to our clients. So that's how we, you know, get people going. And that's really the difference between that and, say, recruiting. Like if you go with a Ronstadt, or if you go with a Kelly Services, I don't know if they're still around. Robert Half. That's a big one. You go with somebody like Robert Half, where it's just straight recruiting and contingent. So that's what makes us different.
So, you know, if I go way back in the day, Ashley did some resume writing as a business a long time ago. One of the things I would tell my clients is to include a line or two about your interest on the bottom of your resume. And the reason I always shared that is if it's just all the education, your experience, all that stuff, there's nothing that differentiates you from your competition. And I always used to explain it to them this way, that interesting people interest people. That if you are an interesting person, during the interview, you might say, you know, for me, for instance, you know, I train in Muay Thai kickboxing and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. The other person might have a kid that takes martial arts, and boom, we've made a connection. So at the end of the day, when they interview 12 candidates, hopefully that interesting aspect about you will stand out. What's your perspective on that?
Oh, I got one for you on that one. Let me tell you when you started talking about that, what that triggered for me. One of the things I coach people on is to have a side hustle. Every executive from CEO down to the janitor in the building needs to have a side hustle. I'm going to tell you why. Some people have described it as the 4 hobbies you should have. I did a post on this not too long ago. One hobby is one to keep your mind going. So a knowledgeable hobby, like learning a language. One should be a hobby that keeps you creative. You know, if you draw, if you, you know, like me, do music, that could be a thing that you do. That's a creative hobby. Another hobby, if I remember correctly, is so we got the knowledge, we got the creative. Oh, one to keep you in shape. So I've got a bicycle downstairs. I ride Specialized for my health. So you ought to have a hobby that keeps you in shape, whether that's cutting grass, gardening, cycling, pickleball, which I tried to pick up last year, for example. That's a new hobby. So you get into that to stay in shape. And the last hobby you should have, if you can, is one that makes money. Definitely makes money. And I read an article, I think today, I don't know if that was the New York Times or where that was. I know it was on LinkedIn, but they talked about how side hustles now, based on generations, now bring in anywhere from $700 to, I think it was $1,200 a month for people. And your Gen Z, your millennials are the ones that have them and make the most money from them. So that's what the article was about. I had to go back and figure out what that was, whether that's New York Times or somewhere. But so you have something that you can do that helps you learn, helps you stay in shape, helps you be creative, and then helps you make a little bit of money. So when you're talking about what you can put on your resume, I advise people to do the side hustles to develop skills that they don't develop in the jobs that they have. So if you want to be, like I did as an example, I wanted to work on public speaking. I said, okay, well, I learned early in my career coming out of A&T that if I don't know how to do what I'm doing right now and knowing how to speak to people and knowing how to present and all that stuff, my career is not going anywhere. So I made a decision. I'm going to get better at public speaking. And I'm not talking about necessarily Toastmasters, even though I did do that one time in my career. I'm talking about finding opportunities, gigs, you know, little side hustle things where I could do that. So what came to me was teaching. I said, if I get in front of a classroom, then I can work on my presentation skills, work on my public speaking skills. So I did that in 2005. And in 2016, I was awarded a Teacher of the Year at one of the universities where I taught. So it was a skill I wanted to develop that turned into
something very, very lucrative and something that I could be very, very proud of. So yeah, I tell you, and that's stuff that you can talk about outside of what you do in a particular corporate space, which does make you interesting and does show you as a person who's versatile, which could help you and give you a competitive advantage.
And that's a nice segue into this next question around, you know, what talk about this notion of mindset versus tool set versus skill set.
we had talked about that. Oh, I mentioned that. I first heard that. I got to give credit where credit is due. So I listened to, I think it's his name, Myron Golden. And one of the reasons I listen to Myron Golden as a guru is because a lot of his stuff, he relates, you know, being a believer and a Christian, a lot of his stuff, he relates to the Bible as he talks about business. In fact, I'm looking at launching a podcast myself around that whole thing called faith, prosper in faith. How do you do that? How do you, you know, make money? How do you take care of your business and still honor what you believe? So that's coming down the road somewhere. But either way, I listened to him, and one of the things was he mentioned this, and then I looked it up just to make sure, you know, it was his or not, so I could give credit. And then I saw the Association of Talent Development, which is a professional organization for learning and development professionals in HR. They had mentioned those three words together as well. So I don't know if he got it from them or he just made it up or whatever, but I'm going to say right now, tool set, mindset, skill set is something I have latched on to. And I'll briefly go through it. You, in order to do what you need to do, you first have to have the mindset to do it. In other words, your belief system. What do you believe? What do you value? How you operate? Those three things in an organization would be considered its culture. So what is your personal culture? What is your personal mindset? To be an entrepreneur, you have to have certain things in your mindset to be successful. You have to take rejection well. Have to have thick skin. You have to, you know, understand risk and take risks, right? So you have to have a mindset around that in order to be successful and move forward. So mindset is one of the three. Then you have skill set. What skills do you bring? And skills are things that are demonstrated as you work. What demonstrable is the word I think I was thinking about. It's something that when I see you, you show me you can actually do. Right. So mindset to do it is one thing. Skill set to do it is a different thing. Right. So skill set is all about making sure you have highly valuable, highly in demand skills, and then the mindset to develop those skills and to be able to apply those to whatever you're trying to do in your venture. So those are the two. And then the last thing is tool set. Now, tool set, the example I could use there is a carpenter who has the mind to build a house. So that's mindset, hard work, work ethic, all that. And understands angles and understands how to do that. Right. So mindset, skill set, they know how to use a hammer and they know how to use a saw. They just know how to do that. They know how to cut wood. They know how to measure twice, cut once. So that's skill set. But then tool set is, am I using an old, you know, saw where I got to use my hand and elbow grease, or am I going down to Home Depot or Lowe's and I'm grabbing a, you know, a circular saw? I can do more with a circular saw than I can if I use the old timer saw where I had to use my elbow grease. So the tools you have also help accelerate your growth and your progress. So what you do is with your career, you say, okay, what mindset do I need to have to get to this destination? Let's say it's CEO. How does a CEO think? What kinds of things go through their mind so that they understand how to progress? So that's mindset. Skill set. Well, what kinds of skills do they have? Well, they get work done through people. They get work done through managers who get work done through other managers. So more of your skill set isn't doing the work. It's inspiring and motivating the work to be done. And you're holding the bag for it. So you're accountable, you're responsible. That's a skill too. So you got skill set, mindset. Then tool set is, okay, what am I using to become a CEO? Am I using a degree that I get from Harvard?
That could be considered part of your tool set because you're going to learn frameworks. You're going to learn different ways to approach things. And depending on what school you go to, you're going to get their flavor of what that is, right? You go to Wharton. Wharton's one of the best schools on the planet for finance. You go to Stanford, one of the best schools on the planet for entrepreneurship innovation. So your tool set is going to come from where you go to school and what they have to offer. So if you put those three together, now you got what I call three set you. You know, how do you get yourself, you know, in the right place? And that's with the three sets.
So speaking of tool set, one of the newest tools out there is artificial intelligence. So can you talk a little bit about how you could go about using AI in your job search?
AI, oh, I tell you. I remember when I was getting into it, because as an entrepreneur, I'm thinking, what do I need to stay on top of regardless? And AI is one of those things. So for me, AI can be used for so many things. A lot of people don't like it. They're scared of it. They think it's going to take people's jobs. My response to that is, I think it's going to take the jobs that no longer need to be here, whatever those are. You know, we don't have too many coal mining jobs anymore. We don't have too many, you know, things that if I go back that far, you know, putting stuff, you know, in like dangerous jobs, working with glass, hot molten lava, steel, we don't have those because we built technology to take care of those. So AI is the next evolution of what that looks like. So what I advise people to do is actually, you know, take a class on it. I did. I took a couple. And one of the things that I use it for in my company as a smaller company is content creation, you know, from a standpoint of the time that it saves me to do things like put together an email that I'm going to send to a client, put together an email as a part of a marketing campaign to send to folks that follow me, for example. If I'm going to do a blog post, I don't go into AI and say, write the blog post. Now, that's not a good way to use it. A good way to use it is to train it so that it gives you responses based on situations, context. Context is everything. So when I'm doing things like a blog post, I did one last week where it helped me write it. I said, okay, what are the top issues facing executive recruiters? It's just spit out a list. I said, okay, with those, give me for each one of those, the top three things that they're worried about. Gave me a list. Then I said, okay, now with the top three things for each one, give me a possible solution to each one of those. Did that. So now I've got all that content. Now I sit and write my post. Then I say, okay, now compare that to something else to make sure it's got my voice, make sure it sounds like me. And then I get a beautiful post, 500 words, 1,000 words, 2,000 words, 5,000 words, right? That I have trained it to do as opposed to told it to do. So I think that's the misconception. And people are cracking down on it because what folks are doing is they're taking their resumes and say, okay, AI, do this resume to get this job. And then they'll put the job description in and AI will write a resume that fits the job description. But what companies are doing is they're putting in these tools to recognize if AI has been used. And they're very, 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 very good of catching that. So now folks are getting in trouble saying, hey, this is my resume. Wait a minute, that says that you jumped into the top of the volcano and swam across the lava. That's you didn't do that. You didn't do that kind of thing, right? So it's catching that kind of stuff and making it difficult. But if you're using it for content, if you're using it for research, if you're using it for, you know, things like my blog post, I'll go to Midjourney and create like an image based on what the blog post is supposed to be about. I'll say, hey, here's what the blog post is. Give me something cool with these different types of artists. The style of the artists, like impressionism, cubism. If you follow Picasso as an example, that art appreciation class did me real good when I started messing around with this, or do it in a 3D isometric representation. So when you see the book I'm going to send you, the guy, those different pieces of art were done with AI. And they were done with me describing that, hey, I'm doing networking. I want some artwork to represent that networking. And I want it in an isometric representation. So it looks kind of, you know, contemporary. He's got that feel to it. And I put the book together. So that's how I'm using AI. And I would advise your listeners to just think about what you want to save time doing, be efficient at doing, and look for ways to incorporate AI into that. And that would be a good place to be.
So a specific question from someone in my network who I told I was going to be having this conversation with you on this podcast.
Okay.
They were like, can you please ask him this question? They have been in the job market and they've submitted their resume, but you know, they have those bots that review the resume. And if you don't have all the right words and blah, 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 it kicks you out.
Yep.
Their question is, what advice would you have for them to, I guess, get past the bot or be more successful in their job search?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to tell you, with the great resignation, as we call it, and other things, and the competition of the job market. In some places, the job market, the unemployment rate is like below national average. It's real, real low. In certain functions, it's real, real low. So you're going to meet competition if you go the traditional routes. Submitting a resume, it's going to a black hole. It's going to really, to be accurate, it's going to, into a, what's called an ATS system, applicant tracking system. And if it doesn't have the right keywords and some of the other things in it, it's not going to be recognized, not going to be acknowledged. Networking is how it's always going to get done. You need to, for the person that asked the question, what I would do is this. I go on LinkedIn. I go to the company that I'm targeting. And what I would do is look for people in the company that you can connect with. And if you can't connect with those people, then find people in your network that are connected to those people and try to get introductions so that the people that maybe the hiring manager or the team get to know who you are before you go put your resume in. So today, I think the last of my 25-year career, the last two or three roles I had, maybe five, I didn't apply for them. And I wasn't a VP yet. Now at the VP CEO level, oh, it's definitely that. It is definitely that. But if you're thinking director level, manager level, even with that, try to find people who work there in the area or close to the area you work and try to network so that they know who you are. Because basically what's coming through that ATS is a stack of resumes, and all of them pretty much, I don't care if you use graphics or not, they all pretty much look the same. So you need that extra edge of, well, actually I see this, I recognize this name. Oh, okay. That was that person who I met at coffee at Starbucks. And yeah. Okay. Well, maybe I want to invite them in for the interview because I got a name with a face that I met and maybe had a conversation with. So that is still the way to get it done, I think, at all levels.
Well, LB, you know this to be true, that, you know, college days swiftly pass and imbued with memories fund.
Yes.
And it's also true for our podcast today. So I want to thank my line brother, David Edgerton, for coming out and sharing this rich knowledge with us today. And we actually learned three lessons from him. Number one, his story around taking challenge and turning that into triumph.
Absolutely.
You know, getting, you know, let go or release from your job and then turning that into something that you own is a huge lesson for all of us. The second thing he talked about was networking, the importance of networking, about seeding, feeding, and weeding your network before you need your network.
It is
a very important lesson. And this third notion around, you know, having these side hustles or hobbies to exercise your mind, your creativity, to keep you in shape as something that generates revenue. And so, Brother Dave, I want to throw it back to you one more time. Any final thoughts you'd like to share with our guests before we go?
Oh, absolutely. I would tell you a couple of things real fast. One, you are the sum total of every decision you've made in your life. So you have to be 100% responsible for your life in order to make it look like you really want to make it look like. And another thing too is, and I could do this in a whole nother conversation with you, but I didn't get to talk about the personal business model. I think that if you are looking to make some changes and to improve your life, improve your career, you have to treat yourself like a company.
So you have a finance department, you have a marketing department, you have an operations department, you have an HR department for your life. So look at business models and what that looks like for your life and how you can become a company or an entity like a company. And if you start looking at yourself as an entity or as an organization, there'd be some great opportunities that come out of that, that you can make some improvement and improve your position in life.
So one other follow-up question for companies, organizations, nonprofits who might be interested in working with you. What's the best way for folks to get in touch?
Oh, absolutely. There's two ways. The first one is the DEJ Group. That's the name of my company. So the DEJGroup.com. There's a contact us on that website. And we share our process for search. We share some other things on that. And recently, I launched my own personal branded site called DavidEdgertonJr.com. Now, on that one, you'll get some of the stuff we talked about. You'll get that, you know, guide that we talked about. And I'm going to be doing some podcasts and some speaking and some virtual events. So if you want to reach out and just follow up or just even say hi, I go to that one too. So the DEJGroup.com and DavidEdgertonJr.com. Those are my two properties that I own. And I even do a talk about the new, what do you call it? The new 40 acres and a mule. I did a talk on that one time where today, the 40 acres is the internet and the mule is your computer. So if you take that, then you got to have your own space on the web, yourname.com, and put your stuff there so people, when they find it, they know what you're about. So that's all I'm doing and trying to demonstrate that for people that follow me.
Well, Dave, if you're willing, love to have you come back for round two and talk about this personal business model.
Oh, yeah. That's a talk by itself.
All right. We're going to do it. Hey, I appreciate your time, brother. Thank you.
You got it.
Okay, 06.
All right.
Black Corporate Life is a leadership training and development company focused on empowering Black professionals to thrive in corporate America. We provide classes, coaching, and an online community of like-minded individuals to help Black men and women in corporate America reach their full potential. Subscribe to our podcast by visiting blackcorporatelife.com or search wherever you listen to podcasts. And join the Black Corporate Life Alliance at bclalliance.com.